Hello, everybody, and welcome to Kentucky Ag Matters, a podcast designed to inform and educate both producers and consumers about all matters affecting agriculture. On this week's show, David, Jay, and Vicki will visit with Dr. Josh McGrath, Extension Associate Professor with UK Cooperative Extension Service. This week, we will discuss soil fertility, efficient nitrogen use, and making the most of your fertilizer dollars in 2022. As always, we'll wrap things up with this week's timely tip. Thanks so much for joining us. We hope you enjoy the show. Well, hello, everybody.
Hey, Jay.
Hey.
Vicki, how are you doing this afternoon?
I'm doing well. I can't complain.
Good.
Yeah, everything's going well. I know that some parts of the around us are a little drier than we've been, so in Webster County, we can't complain. We've really had some timely rains. Crops are looking good, so...
I think we got some rains, I think, is the big deal down in my area. We actually had some corn twisting Saturday on some red hills, probably foot, 18 inches tall, and it was actually twisting middle of the day. I was coming down through there. So we were thankful, got about an inch and a half, so that ought to help a bunch.
I'm kind of like David. I live on one of those red hills, and I've noticed it myself just in my garden. We really could use a drink, and we got a pretty good one the other night. So chance tonight for maybe a little more, maybe a little bit on Saturday. And for those folks outside of Webster County where all things are perfect.
I didn't say it was perfect. I just said we've gotten some timely rains.
We can. I think in a year like this, every rain could be timely for sure.
Absolutely.
This week's guest is Dr. Josh McGrath. Josh is with us. He's the Extension Associate Professor with UK Department of Agronomy, and we're going to talk about a lot of different things today. So, Josh, welcome. Glad to have you with us.
Yeah, thanks for having me. Glad to be here.
Yeah, glad you're with us. If you want to, just start off talking a little bit about your program, and if you want to talk about the inevitable end of your program that's going to come before too long, we'd like you to include that too. So.
Sure. So I've been here since 2014, a soil fertility extension specialist based out of Lexington, and most of my program has been focused on precision research, precision nitrogen management and phosphorus management, soil sampling, done some poultry litter work. I came here from the University of Maryland, where I'd done most of my career. I'd been spent in working on Chesapeake Bay water quality issues, actually, and so coming here was a nice change because I really wanted to focus in on precision ag. That was kind of what my passion was. Unfortunately, kind of mixed emotions. August 1st, I'm going to start a new chapter in my life, and I'm moving over to be a research lead in technology development, I guess is the title, for OCP North America, which is a fertilizer company mainly in phosphorus. So August 1st, but I'll still be around Kentucky for a little while, hopefully helping out and helping to smooth the transition for whatever comes next after me. So, and we've got a lot of research out in the field this year, precision nitrogen research, phosphorus research, and actually going up to look at some field sites in southern Illinois as well tomorrow. So I'll be around to finish up the harvest with that and help kind of transition that over to other folks. So.
Good deal. Well, I'll kind of speak for all agents across the state. We hate to see you go. Glad for you. We know how it is to when you have family and you have obligations at the same time that you want to pursue. But we've certainly appreciated your work here, and I think I could speak for everybody in saying that. But you mentioned just a little bit your work in the past in and around that Delmarva Peninsula area, or Chesapeake Bay, I guess, actually, what you'd said. Talk a little bit about some of that work that you've done in the past.
Yeah, sure. So I was actually born and raised in Delaware, and so that's on the Delmarva Peninsula, and then I spent the first few years of my career at University of Maryland, almost exclusively working on water quality issues. So looking at, some of the things that affect the Chesapeake Bay, there are a lot of factors that affect the water quality there, and one of them is agriculture, and some of that's related to nutrient losses. On the Delmarva Peninsula, there's a lot of manure historically has been applied. Management has changed a lot in the last few decades. And so we're dealing with kind of what they call legacy issues, or these residual issues, because once you build up your soil phosphorus to super high levels, it's hard to get that to come back down. And applying that poultry manure for, 50, 60, 70 years, you end up with soil test values that, it's not uncommon to see 6, 700, 800 wow. pound per acre soil test phosphorus wow. on oh, a wow. lot. And that's sandy ground. So that's like, yeah. you know, it's a colander. Water runs right through yeah. it. So we spent a lot of time working on practical solutions for farmers. We worked on some things like, so the whole peninsula where I grew up is ditch drained, right? Like, so there's ditches that drain all the fields. You're only a couple feet above sea level. And so we worked on filters that actually go into those ditches and use waste products from other industries like steel slag and some things like that to remove phosphorus out of that water before. Because, you know, I think farmers wanted to, they're conservationists at heart. They wanted to do what was right. And so we were trying to come up with solutions to try and help solve that problem. And that's how I got involved in doing precision ag research, because I also think that we can get a lot more efficient with our nitrogen and push yields. When you look at phosphorus, the biggest removal from a field in phosphorus isn't runoff. Like, we focus on the environmental, the phosphorus getting in the Chesapeake Bay, but the biggest removal is yield. So if you want to look at a strategy, not just like a single tactic, but look at it from a strategy, I think driving yields higher to take advantage of the fertility we have in the soil is good for the environment, right? So if we can keep our resource inputs the same for fertilizer and seed and drive yields up, you're going to benefit economically and you're going to benefit environmentally. So that was a lot of my program there. Very involved with all kinds of things. We had to work on some fertility recommendations at Maryland are from the university are actually law. It's kind of a unique situation. So as soil fertility specialist in Maryland, if I said this is how much phosphorus you should apply, that became a rule and you couldn't exceed it. So it was a different situation, but it was an interesting place to start my career. And it was home for me, so I knew a lot of the folks I was working with, so that was nice. But it really set me on this path of looking at precision ag as a way to, instead of what we call extensification, doing intensification. So extensification would be like lower yields across more areas. So think organic production. Nothing against organic production. Economically, there's a lot of money in it. It's good for farmers that want to do that. But that's extensification. Right. Intensification is let's cut back on inputs and drive up outputs. And that's where I started going, because I saw the environmental benefit of that, but also the on-farm benefit. And that's really what precipitated my move here to Kentucky, was to kind of focus more in on those things.
You know, early on in this season, as we started talking about, you know, planting in 2022, we've often referred to mining some of these elements back out of the soil that we've put in over the past few years. And I guess that's kind of what you're talking about in a way.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, that's where with potassium and phosphorus, that's where soil testing comes in. And what's your strategy for management? There's different philosophies that go into soil testing. You know, you might look and you get a private lab runs a sample for you and you send your sample to Extension because it's free and you get the university recommendations and you say, well, you know, this one has a different recommendation than that one. They're all using the same science. They're all running a Malik 3 extraction from, you know, Dr. Malik at North Carolina State made the extraction up back in the 80s. And the private lab, they didn't do any fertilizer calibration trials to figure out what the yield is versus the fertilizer input, right? So they're relying on data that was probably generated at university. It's a philosophical approach. And our recommendations have some buildup at the low end and then go closer to sufficiency, which is the rate that maximizes yield as your soil test goes up. And then they eventually go to zero. And we may differ in where kind of where we cut off at zero. So that might be another difference. And so we've done a lot of research. We continue to evaluate our fertility recommendations. Our soil test recommendations at the university are pretty good. And in a year like this, I mean, you've got to understand there's some uncertainty. So like when I work on precision ag, like one of our field sites will have 300 plots in it. And so that'll be 300 paired plots just with and without phosphorus. So let's talk about phosphorus for a second. When we do those plots, we're putting that phosphorus in the 2x2 with the planter as a liquid, as like 10-34-0 or ammonium polyphosphate, or you could be using an ortho product like 8-24-0 or something like that. And so putting it in the 2x2, instead of focusing on rate, we're focusing on something else there by knifing that phosphorus in offset from the seed row, not on the seed, but offset from it. We're putting it in a concentrated band so the soil can't suck it all up. And then we're making it so it can move to the plant roots better. And so we've seen that we can cut our rate in half just by going to 2x2. So if you're putting DAP on the surface at 200 pounds per acre, you could probably get the same bang for your buck in a 2x2 band with 100 pounds per acre. So we're running on soil tests in a field that has an average soil test of, let's say, 12 pounds per acre soil test P. So really low. And we're running 60 pounds of phosphate. Now, university recommendations would probably be up around 200 pounds per acre of phosphate. But we're seeing 60 pounds enough because we're putting in the 2x2. But anyway, we got those 300 plots out there, and they're actually paired plots with and without phosphorus, just side by side. So all of these plots are super low in soil tests, way below where we go to zero. So according to the university, they should all need phosphorus. And when I take all the fertilized plots and compare the yield to all the unfertilized plots, on average, we've gotten about 18 bushel yield gain from adding phosphorus. So the university was right. When your soil test is 12, you need phosphorus. Okay, that's a no-brainer. But when we look at each of the individual 300 plots, half of them responded and half of them didn't. And so there's spots in that field that didn't need the fertilizer. The soil test in that plot was 12. So the soil test said that plot needed the fertilizer. So why did I get 200 bushels without fertilizer and 200 with fertilizer? I don't know. We think it's root growth. So that's what we're studying, is we're trying to see, did that plot, even though the soil test P was really low, did that plant get a lot bigger roots so it mined what was there? And that's really precision ag and regular conventional ag kind of coming together. Like, so what I can say is, if you're doing flat rate across the whole field and you get a really good soil sample that represents that field, I'm confident our recommendations are good. But if you're doing precision ag, I'm not confident our recommendations support that variable rate strategy, because it's not just soil tests. There's something else controlling that response when we get down to that small area in the field. But the other part of that story is, if half our plots that test at 12 didn't need fertilizer in a year like this where phosphorus is real expensive, I wouldn't be putting phosphorus on my corn this year. Now, I'm going to be going into industry here soon, and I might have a different story opinion in a couple of months.
We'll be sure and date this.
Yeah, so. That's right. That is right.
But it's, you know, so mining, you know, and that's why you soil test. Soil test, see where you're at. And if you're getting close to where UK goes to zero in a year like this with prices like this, cut back, right? And that's why if you've been managing all along, then you can take a year off and save a little bit of money and wait till all the craziness settles out and then go back to your program. But that's why it's so important to have a program and a strategy. And then years like this, you can say, okay, this is a weird year. Let's make an adjustment. You know, lime prices didn't really go up, right? And lime controls P and K availability. So I wouldn't cut back in lime. And that's another reason to always keep your pH right. Because if your pH is right on at 6.5, you can make a lot of mistakes on phosphorus and potassium fertilizer.
We talked about that a lot. It's funny that you bring that up, because we've mentioned, you know, going into the planting season, it seems like every show we did, we would come up the 2022 season and planning and you know, with these high prices and shortage of inputs, you know. And one of the things that we always said was, you know, really look at that pH, look at your soil pH and correct that. Make that a priority.
First.
Yep. Because, you know, really that's where you need to start, regardless of what fertilized prices are, because that's really where you need to start. But particularly in a year like this, you really want to do that, and you reinforce what we've been saying.
We've been preaching it a little bit,
you know, because you kind of get the cart before the horse, so to speak, if not.
We tend to get wrapped up and think about a lot of crazy stuff. People are always asking me about products, like, oh, there's this new, you know, foo-foo juice or whatever I'm going to apply to my fertilizer and all this. And the sound agronomy is going to trump that every day. And we need to always be thinking about those basics. And if my crop budget for fertilizer, if I've got a plant and my budget is $300 per acre in fertilizer, I've got my soil test in front of me, I know what my average corn yield is. I'm talking about corn now, but for whatever crop, the first thing I'm going to do is look at the pH and figure out, I'm going to pay whatever is required to put the recommended amount of lime down. Now what do I have left? Now I've got, out of my $300, I've got $230 an acre left over. Now I'm going to move to nitrogen, right? And then I'm going to look at potassium or phosphorus and see what the soil test is telling me there. But nitrogen, we've done a tremendous amount. I've got thousands and thousands of plots over the last few years in Kentucky on nitrogen. Extensive, going from 0 to 350 pounds per acre 2,000 plots in a field. I mean, that's how we do it. We do really big to look across the whole field on farm, not on station research, but on with cooperating partners in the field. And nitrogen always pays for itself. Even with these crazy high prices, grain prices have gone up too. Jordan Shockley said something once at one of our extension things, the Ag Economist, and do a lot of work with Jordan. He said, if you're buying $1.05 nitrogen, you better be selling $6 corn. But if you look, corn prices went with nitrogen prices. So he's like, when you're buying your nitrogen, make sure you're contracting your corn, because those corn prices will cover those crazy nitrogen prices. Phosphorus and potassium, maybe not. That's why it's so important to have stayed on top of it, mm-hmm. so that when a year like this happens, you can make some of these decisions.
Yep. I've actually got a question about some foo-foo dust after a while.
All right.
So
we get a lot of those questions about the foo-foo dust.
But I did have a question. One of my farmers was talking about applying nitrogen, and he actually applies through Y drops on the top of bare soils. And he was wanting to know, what is the time period where you would start losing nitrogen, or does it cling to soil particles?
Yeah, so the Y drops are interesting. I get a lot of calls about those, and I'm not hung up on Y drops. I'm sure they're fine. Do I need them? First thing you should do when you're managing nitrogen, the big lever, the big knob, for any of those old enough to remember a radio with a coarse knob and a fine knob, a couple of you might remember that. Some of the younger folks in the audience might not.
I do.
The big knob, it's like, you know, if you're worrying about Y drops or some sort of product or additive or whatever, and you're putting all your nitrogen down up front, not like this farmer, but mm-hmm. but if you're putting down 300 pounds of nitrogen as urea before you plant, you've ignored the gash in your arm and you're worried about a little tiny paper cut on your finger. First split apply. So they're already there, right? Because they're already split applying if they're going with Y drops. We do it with a hydraulic hose on the sprayer boom, and we dribble right down the center. I'm sure there's a little advantage to the Y drops, but it's just simple enough to put your hoses on and run. And so we're dribbling down the center. So when you're dribbling that liquid nitrogen, you're actually not very susceptible to volatilization at all. Most research shows that on average, you're exposing about 7% of your nitrogen to loss. Now, most of that happens really when you have volatilization. It actually happens, to be very specific about this question, it happens really quickly, like in the first 24 hours. So when you apply UAN, it's urea ammonium nitrate. So it's got a bunch of water, and then half of the nitrogen is as urea and half is ammonium nitrate. So first of all, the water tends to help carry it down and get in contact with the soil. The nitrogen that's really at risk is what's hanging up on any crop residue in the field. So if there's some cover crop or weeds or old last year's crop, that droplet of UAN that sticks to that plant matter and keeps it from getting in touch with the soil, that's where your volatilization is going to occur. So what happens is that urea gets hydrolyzed by an enzyme called urease, and it converts it to ammonium, right? And if ammonium is touching a soil particle, it's attracted to that soil particle because it's positively charged and soil is negatively charged. So if that ammonium is touching a soil particle, it's stuck and it doesn't go anywhere. If it's not touching a soil particle, then it can go to ammonia gas. It loses one hydrogen, so instead of NH4, it becomes NH3, and then it can pop off as a gas. But because only half of your nitrogen is urea in UAN, and so half of it can't even volatilize, and then because of the concentrated band, there's an effect of that pH in the concentrated band that kind of limits the effect of that urease that's already there in the soil or whatever. It can basically hang out there and wait for a rain to carry it down and get in contact with the soil. And so we see about a 7% loss on average, just kind of rough numbers, plus or minus, depending on conditions. But, you know, if you're side dressing 100 pounds of nitrogen as 32% UAN, that means you're losing 7 pounds per acre. So even with crazy fertilizer prices, that's $7.35 an acre that you're losing, mm-hmm. right? So what's the price of something like MBPT that would limit that volatilization? Certainly would help, but the MBPT, when volatilization conditions are good, you know, humidity, heat, wind blowing, it might last 2 or 3 days. So all it does is kind of give you 2 days that you can wait for a rainfall, or 3 days to wait for a rainfall. That's what the MBPT does. So what's your cost per acre on MBPT? So if it's $10, $15 an acre and you're only losing $7 an acre, you could just, instead of applying 100 pounds per acre, apply 107 pounds per acre and compensate for that loss. So Split applying in season, I don't worry about loss. You're doing everything you can. That is the most efficient thing you can do, going in season. We put 50 pounds down at planting and then come in with the rest at V6, a lot later than many people. We're going V6 to V8 is when we're coming in with, you know, another 200 pounds of nitrogen. I've actually had plots we couldn't get out there on the field, and it was almost tasseling. And that 50 pounds still got us almost a tassel. Between what we had in the soil that we were getting for free and the 50 pounds we put down in our 2x2, again, that's, we're big on 2x2, but a lot of people have their planter set up to dribble it on the surface across the back, a lot of times behind the closing wheels. We also have that set up on our planter. But I'm just a big believer in 2x2. I know it's extra steel on the machine, and you've got the liquid tanks and all that stuff. But, you know, if you can get 35 to 50 pounds out, either through your MAP or DAP, put it down pre-plant with urea, put it down with your planter, whatever, 35 to 50 pounds, and then come in there, because you're smarter in season. That's the other advantage that he's getting, right?
Mm-hmm.
Because not only have you split applied, so you've eliminated all your loss pathways, because water at that point isn't leaching out. The plant's in rapid growth, so it's pulling water up into it. You're not going to lose a lot through leaching. We tend not to have puddling, so you don't have that loss from like a big wet spot in the field. But also, now you're coming in, that corn's knee high. You've had a lot of time to grow, and you know if you're having a good year so far or a bad year, right? Like, if you plant it and you're coming in now with knee high corn and it hasn't rained all season, you know your yield's not there. So you can cut back and save a little money. So you're just smarter. You can make some decisions. You can use some other tools like sensors, Green Seeker sensors that we work with, or Optrix sensors, or Yara makes one, the end sensor, or leaf chlorophyll meter, or you can soil test if you have manure. I mean, that's another, I don't know how much poultry litter you all run it.
There's a lot of poultry litter in this area that you're sitting in.
The best soil test we have is the PSNT, the pre-side dress soil nitrate test. It's better than phosphorus, it's better than potassium, but it only works if you have manure in the system. It doesn't work for fertilizer-only farmers. So you go in there when that corn's 12 inches tall, take a 12-inch deep soil sample, and you can get a NitroCheck kit that works at home pretty good. They're not cheap, but I know some county agents that have them, and I can tell you guys where to get them if you're interested. But also, like, the labs will run them. You can send it into the soil testing lab. Anyway, you run nitrate on that test, and it's a real simple test. If you've applied manure, take that 12-inch soil sample when the corn's 12 inches tall, and if the number's over 20, you don't need to side dress. If it's under 20, stick with your plan. And you can kind of make some decisions. You can say, well, 20, I'm just going to cut in half. But 25, I'm going to go to zero and not side dress. The PSNT is the best test we have. But people just don't like soil sampling this time of year because they got other things happening. And I understand that. But if you've got the time, or you've got the labor, you got somebody willing to go out and take this, that's a great nitrogen tool that we have for manure systems is the PSNT.
Yeah.
You talked about side dressing and the split application, and you talked a little bit about timing. You said V6, V8, you know, it's kind of when you're doing those on your plots. I can remember back, again, when I was started out in the crops, you know, the crop supply business, and, you know, that's kind of when they would side dress. And now a lot of times they start side dressing. I mean, they finish planting and they turn around, they're starting to side dress that first
spiking.
Planted.
Yeah
it's spiking. It's really small. So talk about a little bit about the timing on that. I mean, is that, and I realize why they're doing it, because you know, I think a lot of the times they're doing it, one, for time. They want to make sure they get in, but the other thing is, you know, they want to get in there when they can in case a rain comes in, it sets in raining, and then they can't, they, you know, they get nervous and not about not being able to get in there to side dress that. But talk about that timing on the other end of the spectrum when it's younger. What effect does that have on it?
Yeah. You know, it's funny. That's something that I really saw when I moved out here, and even before I moved out here, talking to my friends in the Midwest, it's kind of a common way to manage nitrogen in the Midwest. And we wouldn't call that side dressing, like coming in that early, right? So I'll say you're not getting the advantage of split application. I mean, it's, you know, typically someone's doing that, they're running a knife rig. So first of all, they're running some sort of coulter where they don't have a lot of clearance, so they don't want that corn to get ahead of them. And I think there's a misconception that you got to be knifing that nitrogen. Now, it is good because, as we discussed, it gets it below that residue. You're cutting it through that residue, so that you've taken that out of the equation. So I'm not saying it's not good. But again, you're kind of setting off that 7% loss, and it's like, is it worth it? And it's a logistics issue. When planters got bigger and faster, it became really inconvenient to have big liquid tanks on them because you're filling up with liquid about five times for every one time you have to fill up for seed. And our time is when we're farming is most valuable when you're planting. I saw something once where it was like some crazy number, how many dollars per hour it was worth when you're planting, right? And I get it. And so you don't want to be stopping five times to fill up with fertilizer every time. But that's kind of how we move to that. So they plant, and then they come in with all that fertilizer. And when you're starting that early, it's no different than putting it down before you plant. And so it's not side dressing.
Right.
I'm fine with starting at V4, which is a pretty small plant. I mean, V4 is pretty small and pretty early in the season, especially when it's been hot like this, right? I mean, we got to V4 fast this year. And if you got your corn in the ground early, which was a whole different story for us. I still have corn in Princeton that we've got to replant. We're trying to figure out how to get it done because now it's too wet. But, so you can start at V4. And you can still get a culture rig across V4, but they're afraid they're going to get blocked out in the field. And so I think if I was farming big acres production, that time was a factor. That's when I would start as V4. And I think with today's equipment, if you can have a sprayer that you're going to use for fungicide, herbicide, and a nitrogen application, now you're using that piece of equipment for more than one operation, and I think it covers the bill, right? Like if you're
further justifies, and
it's really easy to set up, right? Put your spray nozzles on 15 inches. You use every other one when you're side dressing. Again, just hydraulic hose. I just really think that's where I'd invest my time and money because you're going to have a huge advantage of waiting until at least V4. And if you start at V4, it's a little on the early side compared to what I'm doing. I really want to wait a little bit later. That's not a big difference. And so if I start at V4, even if I get rained out a couple of days and I have a pretty I use an old Melrose spray coupe, if any of you are familiar with it. I mean, junky old Melrose spray coupe, and we run that over a lot of acres every year. We had to replace the gas tank and the carburetor on it about a mile and a half in the back of a field we had. We've side dressed when we're hitting the tops of the corn plants with it. Yep. So you don't have to be crazy. I mean, you can get a $7,000 sprayer and side dress all your corn if you're willing to fix things.
Yeah. Well, I do have a question about, we talked about application and how to apply, side dress and doing different things. I've got a farmer that's actually working in my county he's knifing it in and he's running Y drops on the same rig. And in the information that he's getting, and he's getting a six bushel yield bump. What do you think? I mean, I don't know. I mean, it's just that was him, and a guy that stays up on technology and tries different things, and thank goodness for those folks that do try different stuff, so we can kind of understand whether they work or not.
No, that's where we get a lot of our ideas. Sometimes we'll see some things folks are doing and different things. I mean, I think I mentioned our planter. We're running 2x2. We run in for, we do all kinds of studies, and then we're dribbling on the surface. And, some of that stuff we've seen, we picked up from going out to farms and talking to folks. I think at the end of the day, some of that kind of innovative stuff and cutting edge stuff, look, if you're willing to hassle with it, then it's worth it. For you, am I going to say that on every field every year is going to pay for itself? No. I mean, my guess is, as far as nitrogen is concerned, timing going in season, that's the first biggest thing, difference. Right? And then the next thing is, all right, let's think about rate. Yep. And let's think about how we're putting down that 50 pounds to get us the side dress. And so most people don't like the 2x2 approach anymore, although there's some new 2x2 out there on some of the planters that folks are a little bit more comfortable with. But maybe you're putting it out with herbicide. Maybe you're putting it out with your phosphorus or potassium in the spring before planting, and I'm fine with all of that. So you can think about some of that stuff. But as far as getting too crazy, another question kind of along that line, so like that knife and that Y drop, I've seen people call that a relay. Like I guess the thought is I'm getting it close to the plant on the surface, but I'm also getting some down into the soil moisture. And there's some truth to that, right? Like that nitrogen gets into the soil moisture and then it's going to diffuse through that moisture that's in the soil, and then the roots are taking it up through mass flow. I don't think it would provide a huge advantage, but again, like if it's worth it to you, go for it. Another thing along the same lines is people are like, well, I want to go in with two side dress applications. And again, I'm just trying to get folks to do the first, like, real in seed. Like, let's just get to where you're putting some down at plant and some at V6. And if you want to go in there at tassel, that's fine. The way to think about it, though, is at the beginning of the season, if nothing limits your yield, what's your yield potential? Perfect year, best year. All right, let's say it's 300 bushel to the acre. All right, let's say it's a really good field, 300 bushel to the acre. And so our research would show that probably the optimum rate in that field is probably somewhere around 200 to 220 pounds per acre, which is interesting because the really high yielding fields, the unit of nitrogen per unit of yield is less. It's like 0.8 per bushel. In a low yielding field, our research indicates it's like 1.2 per bushel, right? So you actually tend to converge on the same rate. Low yielding field almost needs as much nitrogen as a high yielding field if you do the math. But anyway, so let's just make the math easy and say I need 200 pounds per acre is the exact right rate, and I know that for a fact. And I'm that person, I want to go the extra mile and do a third application. So I'm going to put 50 down at planting. Now I got 150 left to do. Now, Josh McGrath, me, I'm just going to go and put 150 in at V6 to V8, right? And I'm going to call it done. But there's a lot of stuff in the popular press that 50 pounds of tassel is pushing yield. And there might be some truth to that. So I'm going to put 100 down at V6, and I'm going to wait till tassel with the last 50. And the reason I bring that math up, right, so we went from 200, we did 50, 150, is that when people hear about that third application, sometimes they think, I can put an extra 50 and get extra yield, right? And so they do 50, 150, and then another 50, right? That's not the way it works. You have a final yield, and let's assume you got a crystal ball and you know what it's going to be. This is how much nitrogen you need to get into the plant, and what splitting it up does is it makes it get to the plant more efficiently because it allows it to not get lost. So actually, if you're splitting up into three shots, you've decreased how much nitrogen you need because you became more efficient. Mm-hmm. So if I'm going three shots, instead of putting 200 pounds down, I'm going to do 50, 100, and 25. I'm actually going to cut my rate because mm-hmm. I'm doing three shots. Mm-hmm. Whereas I think a lot of people, when they think about those three shots, they think about that third shot as extra. Right. But you haven't changed your yield potential.
Yeah, I think, and you know, there was some talk about putting that through irrigation systems and doing different things down here, and that was the way they were doing it. They were putting extra. It wasn't, you know, they had put everything they normally put, but then they were putting extra at tassel.
The most efficient nitrogen system I ever saw in my career was a farmer back in Delaware that irrigates and uses poultry litter. And, you know, I grew up in Delaware, so I believe in the magic of poultry manure.
Yeah. That's good stuff. I mean? Yeah. Yeah.
So, well, you're in a good spot right here then. This is where the poultry production is.
You know, what they were doing was, and so we, I think we're close to 70% irrigation on the peninsula back home. And so they're irrigating. And they're putting the nitrogen through the pivot. So if you got a pivot, forget everything Josh McGrath told you and put all your nitrogen through the pivot. It's the most efficient thing you can do. Now, these last few years, we haven't had the opportunity to turn those pivots because it's rained so doggone much, right? And that's why you got to have that sprayer as a backup, because if you didn't run the pivot, you got to get your nitrogen out.
Yep.
But, you know, they were running like 8 shots of nitrogen. Now, there's no way for me to research that setting. I can't do split. We don't have the money or the type of irrigation systems at the university to do that kind of research. But, man, they were growing 300, 320 bushel corn with 6/10 of a pound of nitrogen per bushel. They were able to significantly cut, right? So they were running, you know, about 180 pounds of nitrogen and growing over a 300 bushel crop. I mean, that's pretty amazing. Mm-hmm. But again, they were cutting rates because they were slicing it up into fine slices with that pivot. That's the best way to go.
Do you think that part of that too is because if you're irrigating, then that crop's never really going to get stressed from lack of water. So, I mean, I know nitrogen and water, they go together. Right. But, you know, I think that, does that play into that too? Get the nitrogen, you're getting it at the right time or when you need it, but then you're also, that plant's not getting under the stress that it's going to be in if it's in a non-irrigated
normal,
field.
Normal field.
Setting. So, again, take this for what it's worth in Kentucky. On the Delmarva, before I left there, we did some research, and there were a lot of folks. So there were all these rules in place about how much fertilizer farmers could apply, and the bay was still getting worse. Well, there's a lot of lag in the system. Even once you start doing things better, it's going to take a while for that boat to stop moving, right? But one of the complaints was, well, the farmers aren't doing what they say they're doing. They're not cutting fertilizer rates. And so we looked at how much manure is produced, how much fertilizer is sold, and what's the yields. And our data showed that farmers were actually applying exactly right on university recommendations. They were playing it tight. Like, just looking at the exact numbers. Here's how much fertilizer was sold. Here's how much grain was grown. Here's what the university recommendation was. And we were able to estimate that they were pretty tightly following recommendations. But the other thing that came out of that research, and this gets to your point, was that the nitrogen loss to the Chesapeake Bay was driven by weather. And by that, when we looked, you know, our nitrogen recommendations there were yield-based. So just to make it easy, we'll say 1 pound per bushel. And so if you grew 200 bushel crop the last 5 years, you can apply 200 pounds of nitrogen, right? And what we saw was, as the weather, in the years where we had a lot of rain, and we compared nitrogen applied versus harvested yield for the state of Delaware, we were in deficit. We were removing more nitrogen than we were applying. And in years where there was a drought, we were applying an extra 50, 60 bushels per acre. And all that's lost, right? Because nitrogen doesn't stay around. And that's what was damaging the water quality, was the drought years, right? And so it was a little bit counterintuitive, I think, to some of the, I don't want to be disparaging here because I talked to both groups, but some of the environmental groups to say, because it doesn't, like, at first it didn't make sense, like, what's good for the farmer is good for the environment. It was like, if every single acre in the state of Delaware was irrigated, you could take a lot of the nitrogen negative impact out of the equation because you know what your yield's going to be every year.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. So you know your yield. And so, you know, I'm going to get 200 bushels every year. I can apply 200 pounds every year. Mm-hmm. And I don't have that drought year where I applied 200 and got 40 bushels of grain.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Irrigation was a massive BMP to protect water quality. Now, here, access to water, there's some different issues. There, we've got all kinds of aquifers, all kinds of groundwater. So a center pivot, you can put one in every field with no negative impact, right? Can't do that everywhere. But the point to what you were saying is exactly true. You're taking that variability. The biggest thing that damages us in nitrogen economics is uncertainty about how much we're going to yield. If I know what I'm going to yield every single year, I can tell you exactly how much fertilizer you need.
Yeah.
And so that's why our variable rate fertilizer nitrogen studies are all focused on yield prediction. So we're using sensors that are mounted on that side dress unit to predict yield, and every second making a rate change. So we've tested last year. This will be the second year testing the first ever Kentucky yield prediction equation. And we're throwing a new wrench into it this year. So these sensors have been around for a long time. They were developed out of Oklahoma State, commercially available. And so they're using a yield prediction equation. And you travel through the field side dressing at V6. They're sensing the crop. They're predicting the yield and changing the nitrogen rate as you travel across the field. They work great. And now we're going to have a Kentucky equation, right? Well, we're also, a lot of people, the sensors, that's a little tricky, right? Because you don't know how much fertilizer you're going to use until you're done. So that's a little bit kind of hard to wrap your head around. So this year, and that's actually why I'm going up to Illinois to look at some of our fields there, we're going to do satellite images and then convert that to kind of like a sensor basis, a little trick there, but there's people that can do that. And then, you know, I mean, like, you can pay them $6 an acre and get a prescription. And so instead of running the sensor on your sprayer to side dress, you'd pay somebody $6 an acre for a prescription that came from a UAV, a fixed wing aircraft, or a satellite. And then you've got your prescription a week ahead of time. You can say, okay, but this area here, I don't like that. I'm going to change that. You know what I mean? And so it gives you a little more flexibility. But so that's been our approach with variable rate nitrogen, is let's use this technology and it predicts yield. And it predicts yield across that field. And it's pretty good technology.
And
it's amazing.
Talking about the third application at Tassel, that additional, you know, so is the mindset behind that, again, tied to, you know, obviously that's an important time. And so is it, you're lowering the potential stress that crop is in by the, you know, partly because of that additional nitrogen application that you hope then would increase the yield? Is that the mindset at that late application, or what is a mindset?
That's right. If you gain yield, let's assume you have a strip that you put 50 down and then 150 at V6, and right next to it you have another strip where you put down 50, 100, and then another 50 there at that tassel. And if that last one got more yield, it was because some of what you put down at planting or some of what you put down in that other strip at V6 had moved out of that root zone that was taking up nitrogen by mass flow. Like, there's a big zone around the roots that's taking up nitrogen. And so if you got extra yield because you added tassel nitrogen, it just means some of your nitrogen moved away from you. Like, we had a lot of rainfall. So we've seen that in our data. Like, the years when we need more higher nitrogen rates, it's because
lots of rain.
And it was either our yield goal changed, like our average for the last 5 years was 200 bushel, but this is a 300 bushel year, right? So I needed extra nitrogen, or the extra rain pushed the nitrogen out of the root zone, which can happen. And so, you know, a couple big rainfalls and you've got a good well-drained soil and boom, you're running short. That's why splitting it up is such an advantage. The more you split it up, the better.
Okay. I mean, that was kind of what I was thinking, but just,
I mean, you know, our recommendations include, people are sometimes surprised to hear this, and I think some of my colleagues in the university are like, shh, don't tell anyone. But our recommendations include loss. Like, we know that our recommendations, the best case scenario is 60% nitrogen use efficiency, means 60% what you apply goes into the crop. 40% is loss. We're accounting for loss in our recommendation, right? Mm-hmm. And so by splitting it up, you can take out that extra that the university built in, right? Like, if I'm telling you you need 200 pounds, that's assuming split application. Once at planting, once at V6. Now, if you split into three, now instead of 200, you need 175. You split into four, now you need 150. I don't know the exact numbers because we just don't have enough research on that, but I know the more you split it up, the more you can actually cut back because you're taking that loss, right? Your nitrogen requirement is equal to what the plant takes up, minus what the soil gives you for free, plus what is lost. It's a very easy equation. There's three factors: soil supply, fertilizer supply, and loss. And by splitting it up, you're reducing fertilizer loss. And so you're reducing total requirement.
Right. I don't know that a lot of people understand all the research that goes into those recommendations that they get. I guess in their mind, they know that number got there for a reason, but just understanding what you just explained is how that actual recommendation goes in there, and that you all are figuring that loss in there, in that number that they're going to see on that soil test report that comes across, you know, our desk, and then we send it on out to them.
And it's an average. People are like, oh, recommendations aren't that good. Just remember, it's an average. Like, what we're giving you is a statewide average. Mm-hmm. And your field is unique. And that's where the sensors, like, measure that field with a soil test. Measure that field with an optical sensor that measures the crop canopy reflectance. That gives you field-specific information. What was the weather at your field? What was the fertilizer history at your field? You know, like, you can't just use these crude, rough estimates, because that is just a big old rough estimate.
And the farmer themselves are going to know their farms better than anybody else. They may not know the whys, but they can tell you year in and year out.
Record-keeping.
I mean, they know exactly those areas that aren't going
to
yield.
Great reminder to have a strategy. You know, we've talked about strategy all spring long.
Strategy.
What a great reminder to have a strategy about putting nitrogen on. Just, you know, when you don't think about doing some simple stuff, putting nitrogen on is pretty simple. I mean, when you think about it, you just kind of got to decide how much you want to put, how you want to put it down, that kind of stuff. But to have this strategy, I think this moves you to another level when you're talking about production agriculture and being able to reap the benefits of those yields and the things, and trying to control those costs that we have now. This is a great reminder.
I think that's a great way. I know we're getting close on time. I mean, that's a great point to drive home on precision ag. There's a lot up in the air. Like, I just described that. I think we're pulling back on a lot of the variable rate phosphorus stuff and variable rate potassium stuff we thought we knew. We know how to do variable rate nitrogen. It's sensor. Like, there's a million scientific papers supporting that. But what precision ag has given us is that strategy, record keeping. The most valuable thing you've got is that pocket notebook and a pen. Your records over the last 10 years for that field, and precision ag gives us a way to kind of put it all in one thing. I mean, if you were going to go out and learn a new tool, or maybe you have a young person on the farm that's going off to school, man, learn that farm management software.
That's right.
And not just the financial spreadsheet software, but the mapping. Mm-hmm. You know, learn how to run mapping software. There's free mapping softwares available. They're pretty good. There's ones you can pay for. And make that dollar per acre map, and then look at it for 10 years for that field. What? Maybe there's a part of that field that you're losing $5 an acre on every year. go get that waterway money from NRCS, put that grass waterway in and walk away from that, right?
Right.
Yep. And then look, where are you making $600 an acre every year?
And then also, you know, not necessarily grid sampling, like we had talked about that grid sampling earlier, but, you know, looking at maybe really taking some intensive samples in that small area that you're talking about too, because, you know, there may be a pH problem there that you didn't know about from the way that field was divided 50 years ago.
Targeting resources. I mean, but it's that exactly what you said, the strategy. Having a strategy and a plan, and have a backup plan. Right, like my
we've
plan
said
is,
that too. Said that too.
Yeah, you're gonna go in there with starter 50 pounds. I'm gonna come in with 150 at side dress, you know, and I've got a knife rig. What happens if it gets too tall? What's my backup plan? Right, or I was gonna put it on through the pivot, but it's rained every day, so I'm not gonna turn the pivot. What's my backup plan? But still, have a plan and have the flexibility to be willing to adjust it. Like my plan is to apply crop removal of phosphorus and potassium every single year because I'm right on the edge of where the university recs go to zero, and I'm comfortable with that. Until 2022, prices did what they do. I'm flexible enough to say, hey,
I'm done.
I'm not going to pay. I can't pay for 60 pounds an acre of phosphorus this year. Yeah. Think about it. Phosphorus was 85 cents a pound. So if you're applying 100 pounds per acre, right, that's 85 bucks an acre. And if corn is $6 an acre is a good number, 6 into 85, we're getting past my math skills here. I'm a soil scientist. I'm a mathematician, but let's see if I can do this. It's roughly 16 bushels. Is that 100 pounds per acre of DAP going to give you 16 bushels?
16 bushels.
No. I haven't seen 16 bushel yield gain in hardly any of our trials. A few extreme situations, 18 or 20 bushels. So even though it's like you're leaving yield on the table, unquestioned, if your soil test was low, you left yield on the table. Did you leave more yield on the table than the cost of the fertilizer? Probably not. Take this year off. Just know when to retreat from it. Yes, you were going to get 10 bushels. Give up the 10 for the 16 bushel worth of money that the fertilizer is going to cost. Do the math. Just get a pencil out and a calculator.
That's a hard thing for a farmer to do.
I know. Strategy. I'm the same way.
It is. I mean, that is a hard thing for them to do.
Everything you just said has been a recurring theme since this show started back, the first of the year. And, you know, David said it several times, have that strategy. We always like to wrap our show up with a timely tip, and that timely tip today is make efficient use of your fertilizer during the growing season. But to do that, you have to have a strategy. And above and beyond anything else, you have to be willing to accept the fact that you might have to change that strategy at some point during the season. We talk about this just about all the time, but how valuable is that $7 soil test? Right now, we've been pretty spoiled through some of these years of plenty that we've had. But right now, when we talk about the possibility of mining some of this P and K back out of the soil, we don't really know where we are unless we have a baseline with that soil test to be able to do that. And it's the best money you can spend probably right before Lyme as far as your soil fertility program goes.
Oh, it's got to be the highest return on investment on the farm. I truly believe that.
I believe it 100%. And we've talked about that many times.
We
have preached it. We did a lot of preaching, didn't we?
Yeah, we did.
Well, you know, the thing I like to see, though, every time we have a chance to have an outside guest on, they tend to back up what we've been saying all along.
So. That makes you feel good.
Yeah, it makes us feel a little better.
And it didn't cost us anything. We didn't pay him. No checks, nothing like
that. That's a really good retirement
investment. I will say, I heard you say back at the farm day in Owensboro that you liked waterfowl hunt.
Yeah.
And if you get that opportunity, even this winter after you're gone from us, I've got a pretty nice place over in the Boot Hill of Missouri. Some guys that I hunt with over there. You'll have to come down and jump the duck blind with us one day.
I'll have to holler at you. Hopefully I'm going to have more time for that with this new move. So, Absolutely.
Well, we appreciate you being here today. We want to thank Dr. Josh McGrath, again, extension specialist for a little while that we get to use him, and our host for this week's information. And thanks to the listeners for joining in, as always. We hope you've enjoyed our show, and we'll make plans again to join us next week for our next episode. And until then, remember, Kentucky Ag matters.
That was a bunch of fun.